Good morning. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Ahmad Desponde. Dr. Desponde is the Associate Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He completed his medical degree at the University of Miami School of Medicine and stayed there and the Jackson Memorial and University of Miami system, where he did his internal medicine residency and gastroenterology fellowship. He sees patients and does research at the University of Miami Crohn's and Colitis Center. He's co-director of the Advanced IBD Fellowship and Vice Chief for Education in the Division of Gastroenterology. He's authored many articles, books, and chapters and reviews in prestigious gastroenterology and internal medicine journals with multiple presentations at national and international meetings. He is a reviewer of the multiple gastroenterology journals and sits on the editorial board of the Journal of Crohn's and Colitis, as well as other IBD-related advisory boards. This morning's topic is update inflammatory bowel disease. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Desponde.
Thank you very much for having me. I heard that it's a mix of residents and GI specialists and internists, so it's a wide, diverse group of learners. So I tried to touch on a few important things. So no relevant disclosures. We'll talk about some of the current understanding of new updates in pathophysiology, which has really increased tremendously in the past decade or so, and some of the current therapies that we use. But more importantly, I'll kind of talk from the perspective of to some degree, internal medicine about treating patients and appreciating appropriate risk-benefit ratio. I may get a little philosophical. If I do, you can just throw something at me and tell me to get off my soapbox. And then we'll talk about, again, from the perspective of internal medicine, some of the important considerations in preventive care and the role of the internist and the gastroenterologist in caring for IBD patients outside of the actual therapies that we provide. So more for the internists, I know you already know this, but we frequently in medical records, certainly with patients and with doctors alike, see this this confusion, or not this confusion, but this using these terms interchangeably, IBD and IBS, two very different issues. So inflammatory bowel disease is the subject for today's talk, which deals with chronic intestinal inflammation, classically on a spectrum from Crohn's disease to ulcerative colitis. We'll talk about how that's not such an important distinction for many, in most cases. As opposed to irritable bowel syndrome, I put no tissue abnormality yet because there are many studies now looking at different amounts of eosinophils and mast cells and duodenal biopsies, for example, in patients with upper GI functional dyspepsia, and the same in people with IBS. But it's really a larger umbrella term of functional GI disorders. There's this criteria called the Rome IV criteria. We're not going to go over any of this today, but it's really quite different from inflammatory bowel disease. These people have no known tissue abnormality. We don't treat them with anti-inflammatory or immunosuppressive therapies, and it is mostly treated symptomatically, although we're now coming up with targeted therapies, but isn't the topic for today's discussion. I mostly put it on here because I want to differentiate the two diseases, IBD and IBS, and also so I could make an excuse to put up, I think, the best slide of the day, which is always showing. I can't get through any talk without talking about the Bristol stool scare. So this is how we actually, most studies use to determine whether people have diarrhea or constipation. So I mostly put it up there so you can kind of introspect a little bit and think where you were in the past 24 hours. The dream is four. So, like, that's where everyone's goal should be. We're all high-achieving people in medicine, so you should all shoot for a four. One in seven are not where you want to be, so just always remember to. And I actually, as a fellow, had this, like, right above my toilet paper dispenser in the bathroom. I've grown. I'm a lot more mature now, so it's still there. So, again, looking at the two major distinctions, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, I'll talk a little bit about how this distinction is less relevant genetically and certainly environmentally, but there are some differences. So ulcerative colitis, by definition, as you all know, is confined to the colon. That can be ulcerative proctitis, only the rectum, left-sided colitis, or involve the whole colon. Conversely, Crohn's disease can involve any part of the GI tract, classically the terminal ileum and the right colon, but certainly anywhere from mouth to anus. There are certain differences in different cultural groups. So, for example, Black Americans tend to have more perianal disease. Older onset IBD is more colonic, as is pediatric IBD, whereas typical kind of 20s and 30s age range, Crohn's disease typically is ileum, terminal ileum and right colon. And about 5 to 10% of people have upper GI tract involvement. But a very heterogeneous group of disorders that we kind of put under one umbrella. So I'll talk just for a few minutes about where we currently are in 2017, understanding why IBD occurs. This really has undergone a revolution in the past decade and a half or so from what we used to understand at the turn of the millennium. And so the three major components that contribute to understanding the etiologic theories of IBD today are the environment, the genetics of the individual person, as well as the community, and both innate and adaptive immune system, mucosal immune systems, more so the innate system. So I'll tackle the genetics first. This is a genome-wide association study from about 4 years ago, looking at a meta-analysis of all the GWASs that existed at the time in IBD, and that's where we were up to 163 confirmed loci associated with inflammatory bowel disease. I put this up there to highlight two major points. I'm not sure if the pointer works, but here on the top right, you'll see that IBD is in dark purple. And the point of this top right part of the slide is to just show you there's a lot of overlap between other mycobacterial diseases, immune-mediated diseases, primary immunodeficiency diseases. Here's another mycobacterial disease. And so overlap with both immune diseases and with infectious diseases, particularly mycobacterial diseases. There's actually a group of people, mostly in Australia, who want to believe that Mycobacterium paratuberculosis is strongly associated with IBD. That's not been debunked, but mostly been refuted. But the important point is that there's a lot of genetic overlap between IBD and other immune diseases and infectious diseases. So there certainly is a continuum there. And the other important point that I wanted to make on this slide is that we spend a lot of time perseverating on whether someone has Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. That differentiation is mostly created by us because we want to be able to understand the disease better. If you look genetically, 110 of the 163 loci associated are common to both diseases. And we know from older studies that 15% of people have what we used to call indeterminate colitis, kind of a little bit looks like Crohn's, but also partly like ulcerative colitis. And so I wouldn't spend too much time differentiating those two. They are important for like clinical trials to some degree and some therapies, but for the most part, that differentiation is less important, certainly genetically, where the great majority of these loci are common to not only UC and Crohn's, but also to other pathways of infection and inflammation. And so by early 2017, as of about a month ago, we're up to almost 200 loci that are associated with inflammatory bowel disease. And as I mentioned, a lot of enrichment of overlap if you read genetic studies. This is a term that's frequently used. And so things like ankylosing spondylitis, psoriasis, there's a lot of overlap. I recently gave a talk to the dermatologists about psoriasis and IBD drug overlap. And pretty much every drug we're using in IBD is being studied in psoriasis, and every drug that's in psoriasis is being or has been studied in IBD. So there's a lot of overlap between other autoimmune diseases and inflammatory bowel disease. And so you can see here that the first genes that were really found were a gene called NOD2-CARD15 at the turn of the century. And since then, for the first several years, they were basically discovering about a gene a year. But with genome-wide association studies and looking at big chips of data and being able to look at a large amount of DNA, there's been an exponential increase in how many genes we've found associated with IBD. And so this is up to 2012, and I told you as of 2017, it's up to 200. The challenge is that though we're finding more and more genes that are associated, and you see here that in 2008, those 32 loci accounted for about a fifth of the heritability of Crohn's disease, we still don't totally understand all of that interaction. So how many more polymorphisms or single nucleotide polymorphisms are there that we don't know? And what about the role of epigenetics? So not just the genetic code, but also environmentally how these genes are modified, hypermethylated, for example, to affect the resultant proteins. And perhaps most importantly, what combinations of genes are needed? So you can say that somebody, if we did a genetic study on all of us, nearly everyone here would have a few of these 200 loci that could be associated with IBD, but very few of us will actually develop inflammatory bowel disease. And so what combinations of these genes are needed for us to really understand who's going to be at risk for IBD and what are those implications long-term about potentially treating people prophylactically? And so we still have a long way to go in our understanding of the genetics. But beyond genetics, it's a lot more than that. There's a familial component, and whether that's the epigenetic component, we don't know. So there are people that have very few risk loci for IBD that still develop it, who have a family history of IBD. So maybe that's not the genetic code per se, but epigenetics. We know that there is more monozygotic than dizygotic concordance. Yet, if you take a group of monozygotic twins, one of whom has Crohn's disease, only half of those twins that are monozygotic will develop this disease too. And those people have obviously identical genetic codes. And most of them have pretty similar environmental exposures too. So there's very few studies that can take monozygotic twins that were separated at birth and follow them through time. So most of them are essentially the same environmental, though not identical, environmental exposures, and only about 20%, even lower genetically for UC. So we know that there's partially a genetic component, but there's also obviously a strong environmental component as well. And so the hygiene hypothesis has been talked about for now at least 15 years. And you can see here from the New England Journal from about 2002, the rapid decrease or the significant decrease over the past several decades in a lot of infectious diseases that correlates very well with the rapid increase in autoimmune diseases, asthma, autoimmune diabetes, multiple sclerosis, and Crohn's disease. And so this certainly could be coincidental, but there is a hygiene hypothesis in that as we've gotten cleaner and cleaner as a society, we've had less exposure early in life to antigens that would lead to a tolerant immune system. And so when you get your first infection, of rotavirus or salmonella when you're 3 or 4 years old, you have a relatively naive immune system that overreacts to that antigen or bacterium and then causes an immune cascade that doesn't shut off. And as opposed to people who were, you know, born in other centuries or other parts of the world where you aren't, you know, here you're born by C-section, put in an incubator, you put socks on, you wash your hands 15 times a day, and don't let the kid do anything. Whereas in other countries, the kid's like eating dirt when 2 weeks into their life. And so, I'm not advocating for rheumatic fever and hepatitis A, but I will say that as we've become such a relatively sterile society, we do know that the immune system has become much less tolerant early in life, and so your first antigenic exposure can be a significant one. And so there's two major ways in which the environment can affect inflammatory bowel disease, certainly by changing the microbiome, which is a big topic for a lot of autoimmune diseases today, as well as mucosal disruption. So mucosal disruption is a little more straightforward. Things like NSAIDs and stress and smoking can all disrupt the mucosa and cause ulcerations. But the changing of the microbiome also significantly contributes to the environmental portion of IBD. And so there are things that may not even be all that intuitive. So there are several studies in celiac disease, for example, that those born by C-section are far more likely to develop celiac disease than those born by vaginal delivery. And this speaks to the fact that in the first several weeks of life, people born by C-section have a much different microbiome than people born by vaginal delivery because you're exposed to your mother's vaginal flora very, very early in life. That sort of equilibrates over the first year of life, but certainly there are some longstanding changes that that have been shown in celiac and to a lesser degree in Crohn's disease, both very mucosally immunologic autoimmune diseases, to affect your likelihood later in life of developing these diseases. So, similarly, the longer you breastfeed, the less likely a child is to develop over the next few decades autoimmune diseases. And antibiotic exposure has been strongly associated. So kids who have had more otitis media as a surrogate for more antibiotics are more likely to develop inflammatory bowel disease. And in Scandinavia, those kids who developed an enteric infection in the first 3 years of life were 4 times more likely to develop IBD over the next 30 years. And so there are relatively compelling data to believe that if you're exposed, your microbiome changes early in life, whether through antibiotics or through mode of delivery or through breastfeeding, that can confer long-term effects downstream. This certainly isn't compelling enough for us to tell or suggest to a woman how to deliver in 2017, but there are considerations to think about as women are as you do preconception counseling on women with inflammatory bowel disease. And then another thing that is interesting about changing the flora is acculturation of food and nutrition. So food is foreign proteins being to which the intestinal mucosa is being exposed, and different types of diets will change your microbiome in different ways. And acculturation refers to if you have immigrants that move to this country. So in South Florida, in Miami, for example, you have many people that move from Central and South America. Some of those people will move from Cuba into Little Havana and basically never change their culture and eat the same food and have the same lifestyle. And others will move to other parts of South Florida and start eating McDonald's when they're 5 years old and significantly change their diet. And the rate at which a group of people accultures into that other society does affect the degree to which they take on the diseases of that group. And it's not just hygiene, which we mentioned a couple slides ago, but we know, as I mentioned, the diet now has antibiotic processed meat, there's processing, there's preservatives, additives, and everything that we eat. And so these by themselves can lead to changes, and so I don't want to spend too much time on the actual science of this paper, but it was a very provocative paper in Nature a couple of years ago that suggests that when you're exposed to different types of food, it actually changes the distance that the bacteria have from your intestinal epithelium, how much of a mucus layer you have, and that can significantly affect your risk for inflammation of the colon and the small bowel. So the food is not just affecting the microbiome, it's probably infecting the mucus layer as well. And so subtle things that we don't necessarily spend a lot of time talking about with our patients, because we don't really know the answer yet, is that different types of diets invariably lead to different phenotypes of disease. And patients will tell you this, because they tell you when they eat certain types of diet with more red meat or more alcohol or more processed foods, they feel worse. Whereas when they have a cleaner diet, if you call it that, then they feel better. So we certainly have anecdotal evidence, and we now have some basic science evidence to support that. So at the end of the day, is it nature or nurture? And this is a complex question. There clearly are racial and ethnic differences in phenotype and presentation of IBD, suggesting a genetic component or at least an epigenetic component. We know that the age of diagnosis and IBD subtype are different, for example, in Black Americans versus Hispanic or white Americans. We know that non-Hispanic whites have more gastroduodenal involvement. We know that we did a study that is referred to here that extra infinitesimal manifestations like PSC are different in different groups of people, though we didn't find that in a group of Hispanics in Miami. And we know that non-Hispanic whites have more surgeries and more use of stronger medications like biologics and immunomodulators. So we have an opportunity in Miami to look at three very unique groups of people. We look at people that are longstanding Caucasian Americans that have been in this country, whose families have been in this country for many generations. We have first-generation immigrants who came from Central and South America, and then we have the kids of those people, so first-generation Americans who have the genetics of someone in Central and South America, but the environmental component of someone who's lived in America for a long time. And so we looked at those three groups by phenotype, and what we found was, as expected, the non-Hispanic white, the typical kind of Caucasian American who's been here for 100 years, whose family's been here for 100 years, is mostly a younger onset, age 27, and Crohn's more than UC. So the 27-year-old with Crohn's is your typical kind of white American phenotype. The ones who were foreign-born Hispanics, those who came from other countries, presented more with UC than Crohn's and more in their 40s rather than their 20s. And so those were two very different phenotypes. And when we looked at that middle group, kids who were born to parents who have genetics of someone from Central South America, but the environment of somebody who's longstanding American, they looked a lot more like longstanding Americans than they did like their parents, suggesting that the environmental component is significant because environmentally they look a lot more, or phenotypically they look a lot more like the people to whom they're environmentally similar, more so than those to whom they are genetically similar, suggesting again that there's a strong environmental component to this. So invariably, we know that there's a strong genetic and environmental component. There's a lot of research now trying to understand better how that interaction occurs. But irrespective of how those things occur, we do know that what then happens is at baseline, our gut is mildly inflamed. So we have 100 trillion bacteria in our GI tract, and a lot of secretory IgA and a lot of the very active innate immune system in our gut. So at baseline, we have a mildly inflamed, intentionally fight to control these bacteria gut. But then you have an exposure to some gastroenteritis. Here, that could be E. coli, salmonella, it could be a viral gastroenteritis, and then you get a moderately acutely inflamed gut appropriately to kill that pathogen. But in the right combination or the wrong combination of genetic and environmental predispositions, most of us, if we have an E. coli gastroenteritis, we will appropriately upregulate the immune system. When that E. coli is dead, we'll then downregulate back to our normal baseline state. So you'll feel awful for a few days or a week, and then you'll go back to your normal gut. But in people who are genetically predisposed to IBD with the appropriate environmental exposures, they will have a failure to downregulate that immune system, and your mucosal immune system will be constitutively turned on, and you can't shut that off, and that leads to the chronic inflammation that we see in inflammatory bowel disease. And so it's a complicated cascade of what's happening. We know that the CD4 helper cells are really important in this, and so if you remember from immunology, you have TH1 cells, TH2 cells. About 10 or 15 years ago, this discovery of the TH17 pathway, which upregulates things like IL-17, and certainly the regulatory T cells are all kind of involved in this. And we have the innate immune system as well as the adaptive immune system. A lot of secretory IgA that you see in green at the level of the interface between the environment and the immune system. And so a lot of different immune pathways that are activated and up and down regulated. And this provides us the basis for coming up with therapeutic targets in IBD. And so you'll see on this slide things like TNF-alpha which is upregulated in IBD, which is why one of our cornerstones of treatment is anti-TNF-alpha medications. Recently approved 4 or 5 months ago was ustekinumab, which is a blocker of IL-12 and IL-23, or the P40 subunit common to those two interleukins, which you also see on this slide, and other things as well. And so a lot of the future therapies that we're looking at in IBD are looking at blocking things like IL-17 and IL-13. And so this kind of understanding of the immune system forms the basis for how we're going to kind of look at therapeutic targets down the line. So I won't spend any more time on the future of IBD therapy because that's not relevant to your practice today, but we'll talk a little bit about the presentation of IBD and how it looks endoscopically, and then some kind of general ideas on how we treat IBD. So as many of you know, the symptoms of IBD can be relatively nonspecific: diarrhea, abdominal pain, anorexia, weight loss, fever, fatigue, rectal bleeding, usually more so with colonic disease, and colitis more so than with Crohn's disease. Importantly, in children, failure to thrive and stunted growth and falling off the growth curve. So for pediatrics, gastroenterologists and pediatricians, this is an important thing to consider when kids aren't growing appropriately. And perianal disease can be very debilitating for young people who have perianal fistulas. And so this is a picture of a normal appearing colon. For the gastroenterologist in the room, this is very apparent to you. But for those that don't routinely do endoscopies, this is the normal vasculature and mucosal appearance of the colon. You can compare that to what you see here. So on the left, you see this ulceration here at the bottom part of this endoscopic picture, which is with otherwise relatively normal mucosa. Here you see several ulcerations throughout most of the circumference of the endoscopic picture. And then here you see a stricture or a narrowing. So the normal lumen, as you see, is about this wide across, and here the lumen is narrowed down to this much. And so you can get stricturing disease, inflammatory disease. You can get, that was in the colon, this is in the ileum. Again, various pictures showing you inflammation, longitudinal ulcers that cross folds. Here's a deep ulceration in the terminal ileum, in the colon as well. Here's a relatively normal colon suggesting that we can have very much skip areas of normal colon with intervening significant inflammation. Here you see some deep ulcerations. Here you see really relatively diffuse inflammation that almost looks a little more like ulcerative colitis than Crohn's disease. It can also affect the upper GI tract. Here is the pylorus in the top left, and so you see a lot of antral inflammation. You can see ulcerations throughout the duodenum and the stomach. And here you see the chronic inflammation of the pylorus leading to a relatively small pyloric opening, and that can lead to things like gastric outlet obstruction. So it can be throughout the GI tract. And perhaps one of the more debilitating parts for young people socially is having perianal fistulas with perianal drainage. Having to wear pads and having to wear diapers is obviously, as you can imagine, for someone who's in middle school or high school or even in adulthood, can be very socially challenging. Here you see what we don't usually get lucky enough to see, which is the actual internal opening. This is the scope right here, turning back on itself to look at the dentate line. And here you see a fistula that's evident here. What we more commonly see is external. So here is a picture of a patient who actually has already had some surgical intervention. These orange rubber band looking things are setons. But you can see this woman has had not only significant active fistulas, but also, as you can see at the top here and the bottom here, several prior fistulas as well. And this can make it very challenging. And this is one of the hardest parts of IBD to treat, is active perianal disease. Some of our therapies work pretty well, but a lot of them are incompletely effective at treating a lot of these perianal complications. And so, as I mentioned, you can have inflammatory disease, and that can lead to both inflammation and relative obstruction by causing narrowing either from acute inflammation, or from chronic inflammation leading to strictures that lead to bowel obstructions, and they can be segmental over much of the bowel. If you have transmural inflammation of Crohn's and two pieces of bowel are in proximity, you can get fistulization. So this is an enteroenteric fistula, but you can get fistulae to many places. You can get small bowel to bladder, small rectum to vagina, small bowel to skin. And a lot of these are also very debilitating for patients as well. And then finally, if you do have that same transmural inflammation, but instead of eroding into another piece of lumen, it erodes into free space, that would be a microperforation. Here you see the terminal ileum, usually right next to the appendix, which is oftentimes why the initial presentation of Crohn's disease can mimic appendicitis with right upper quadrant pain, and even potentially imaging studies that show a phlegmon in the right lower quadrant. It's assumed to be appendicitis, but really was the initial presentation of Crohn's disease. We do have much better imaging. We used to have small bowel series, which are still used at times. But here you see enterographic imaging, where you can see a normal bowel here with the normal thickness of the wall that's enhancing with contrast, and the normal lumen of the bowel. And here you see this loop right here, or also you can see it here, a much more thickened wall from inflammation, and also a much more narrow lumen in dark here, causing relative obstruction. And so you can hopefully understand how this can cause both pain and many other systemic symptoms when you have these relative areas of obstruction. And importantly, this is someone in whom a colonoscopy with ileal intubation and a small bowel follow-through could be normal. You don't really get to see that transmural inflammation on small bowel series as well as you can here, because you have the opportunity to use IV contrast, where you can see if these things are hyper-enhancing, which you really can't see on an older small bowel series. So that's Crohn's disease. Ulcerative colitis is easier in the sense that it's very apparent as soon as you put the scope in the anus, and within a few centimeters, you can tell if someone has UC or not, because by definition it starts at the dentate line. Here you see a normal colon more proximally in this patient. This would be an example of mild to moderate UC. The term ulcerative colitis is maybe not the best term, because usually you don't see discrete ulcers. It actually, the way we describe it to patients is like someone took sandpaper to the lining of your colon and irritated the whole thing circumferentially. So this would be a mild to moderate ulcerative colitis, and this is a much more severe colitis, and this would be severe UC. Again, you see completely circumferential colitis involving the whole diameter or circumference, I should say, of the colon. And it'll be contiguous like this up until a break point, at which it'll be completely normal, proximal to that, unless they have pancolitis. And we determine the severity of UC. The American College of Gastroenterology has these practice guidelines, mostly based on the frequency of stools and the severity of systemic illness, going from mild to moderate to severe to fulminant. And these terms become important as we decide what treatments to use. So, for example, mesalamines are relatively effective in mild to moderate UC. In severe UC, you have a small chance of those working, but really you're looking at steroids, oftentimes IV steroids, and really inducing them with anti-TNF therapy to be able to induce remission. Unlikely to get remission in severe disease with mesalamine therapy alone. And then it's important as internists certainly to appreciate all the extraintestinal manifestations of inflammatory bowel disease. On the top left is an example of episcleritis, which differs from uveitis in terms of whether or not they have photophobia. And this oftentimes needs to be seen by an ophthalmologist, oftentimes responds to things like steroid eye drops, but many times needs stronger therapy. On the top right, you see some examples of aphthous ulcerations, more oftentimes on the buccal mucosa than underneath the tongue. On the right, you see erythema nodosa, which are these purplish lesions, oftentimes that are very tender on the anterior surface of the shins. At the bottom, you see pyoderma gangrenosum, which is a very ulcerative lesion that can occur as well. And then they also are at significantly increased risk of cholesterol gallstones and calcium oxalate kidney stones. And there are pathophysiologic mechanisms for why that occurs in small bowel disease. And so it's really important to keep those things in mind. If a Crohn's patient comes in with abdominal pain or flank pain, that could be a flare of their Crohn's, but it also could be something like a calcium oxalate kidney stone or a cholesterol gallstone. So when patients initially present to us, UC usually will look a little bit like an infection. And so it's important to ask when someone has new onset bloody diarrhea, for example, for their travel history, their exposure history, if anyone else is sick in their family, and also chronicity, because essentially by definition we try to avoid doing endoscopic procedures on people who've had diarrhea for less than a few weeks, because it's overwhelmingly likely to be infectious. So certainly stool studies for infection are important. And just remember that when we say, you know, a lot of times we'll use this term, the stool cultures are negative. If someone's stool culture is negative, then they've been grown in a germ-free lab. Like, that's not possible. Everyone has thousands and thousands of bacteria in their stool, and so no one has a negative stool culture. And when you order your typical stool cultures in the hospital, it's basically checking for usually Salmonella, Shigella, sometimes Campylobacter, and in some hospitals, Aeromonas and Plesiomonas. It's looking for four or five species. And so if you have a specific consideration for a specific infection, you have to order that specifically. So if you're worried about Vibrio or Yersinia, or in an immunosuppressed patient, Isospora or Cyclospora or Cryptosporidium, you have to order those as individual studies in most labs, because they're not going to be able to run, they don't run all of them at once. Some of these newer outpatient labs will do it, but for the most part, you have to ask for the specific infection about which you're worried based on their travel and exposure history. And then we now have much better tests for stool inflammation. So I haven't ordered a stool, a leukocyte count in, I don't know, several years, because we now have better tests, lactoferrin and calprotectin. So we routinely use calprotectin. I think in the outpatient setting, it sometimes is challenging with some insurance companies, but in the hospital, it shouldn't be. And calprotectin is a very nice way to non-invasively follow someone's degree of inflammation. It's basically looking for products of degradation of neutrophils in the stool. And so people that have inflammatory components to their diarrhea will have elevated calprotectins, as opposed to someone, for example, with IBS, who should have a negative or a low calprotectin. It's a very nice non-invasive way of looking for inflammation. Certainly we have serology. So people talk about the P-ANCA and the ASCA as ways to check for IBD. These are relatively unhelpful in most cases, but there are panels of antibodies that are done by commercial laboratories that will look at a combination of ANCAs and ASCAs and other antibodies against microbial products that you can use to see if somebody is more at risk for IBD, and then certainly inflammatory markers. I've actually gotten rid entirely of ESR in my practice. I only use CRP. There's a nice study from University of Pittsburgh looking at all the people that have had high ESRs with normal CRPs. And in all those cases, when you then do the endoscopic evaluation, the CRP was correct, not the ESR, meaning that there wasn't active inflammation. So I actually find very little incremental benefit in adding an ESR to a CRP. Certainly, most people still do it, but I think the CRP is a more sensitive marker for inflammation in these patients. And in ulcerative colitis, I tell our residents and fellows that to me, a UC flare, it's history, physical, sigmoidoscopy. I mean, the sigmoidoscopy is almost a part of the physical exam in someone who comes in with known UC and a flare, because you really want to be able to you don't have to do a full prep and a full colon with sedation. You can just put an endoscope in a few centimeters without sedation, look for the degree of inflammation, get some stool if you haven't already for C. diff, and certainly potentially take biopsies for CMV if they're immunosuppressed. And that should really be part of your physical exam for those of us that have access easily to endoscopy for patients that come with a flare of ulcerative colitis, unless you have a really good reason why they flared. So someone who now is known to be C. diff positive, or someone who you know ran out of their medications 2 months ago and now is coming with a flare. Anything short of that, you should really consider doing a sigmoidoscopy. Have a low threshold as part of either your initial presentation or following up a flare. And then in Crohn's disease, it can also look like infection, but oftentimes can mimic appendicitis. So we now have much better two-dimensional imaging, so CT and MR-based enterographic protocols. It's a lot more contrast for them to drink. It's not barium. It's a neutral contrast, but more volume. And that can actually distend the bowel well and look at the bowel thickness and the degree of inflammation quite nicely in CT and MR enterographies. I personally prefer MR enterographies because we irradiate our young people too much as it is. But if you don't have local expertise that feels comfortable in routinely doing those, CT enterography is also a very reasonable option. And in Crohn's disease, unlike in ulcerative colitis, where you can just put the scope in a few centimeters, unfortunately with Crohn's, to get a good evaluation of the mucosa, you really need to do a full ileocolonoscopy, getting into the colon all the way around and into the terminal ileum if you really want to assess their likelihood of having active Crohn's disease. The same stool size for infection and inflammation can still be used, and the same serologies and inflammatory markers as well. So that's IBD initial presentation in general. So for the purpose of hospitalization, many of you do a lot of inpatient time in residency. What are the reasons that we hospitalize IBD patients? So certainly severe disease is refractory to outpatient medical therapy, and complications of both disease and treatment are important things. So I'll just present to you a little bit of the current data, because for those of you that are residents that are treating patients, you're more likely to be dealing with these patients, I think, as an inpatient, more so than as an outpatient, how we deal with things like acute severe ulcerative colitis. I'll show you some of the current data on how we treat them. So ASUC is acute severe ulcerative colitis. And so we know, unfortunately, to date, the single best drug we have for IBD, if you look at the ability to acutely improve somebody's symptoms, is still corticosteroids. And I say unfortunately because we hate it long-term, and it has a lot of bad effects long-term, and has no data that it improves the natural history of the disease, but it still is the best thing that we have up front. So to date, this study is 15 years old from Mayo, still showing that, but this is still true, that in the first month, about 85% of people will respond to steroids. The problem is that if you go out to a year, only about half have that prolonged response. And in this study, back before TNFs were routinely used, the rest were either steroid-dependent or went to surgery. And so it's a great initial drug, but it should, every time you start steroids, there should immediately, at initiation, be a plan in your mind of how you're going to get them off steroids, because long-term, it doesn't help their disease long-term, and it causes a lot of complications in the process. So when you guys admit patients to the hospital, and put them on IV steroids. I personally prefer methylprednisolone because of its combination of mineralocorticoid and glucocorticoid effects. You can use hydrocortisone. I'm not aware of any studies that show this, that shows one is better than the other. We usually use methylprednisolone 20Q8. You can use hydrocortisone 100Q8. But you don't need those doses that the neurosurgeons use, like it's 1,000 Q2 or whatever crazy amounts of steroids that they use in other diseases. 60 milligrams or so a day of methylprednisolone is about as much as you need. Similarly, there's no data that anything more than 40 milligrams of prednisone is superior to 40. So people sometimes use 60, 80, and 100. Certainly they use that in rheumatology and in other diseases. But in IBD, there's no significant data that shows that anything more than 40 of prednisone is effective. So how can we put, so we put someone on IV steroids in the hospital, how can we predict if they're going to do okay? So there is this this scoring system where you can look at day three, so 72 hours into their course of IV steroids. And one of the challenges here is we're so used to admitting people, for example, with COPD and asthma exacerbations, where we put them on a five days of steroids and stop it, and they oftentimes do a lot better on steroids. You have to be more patient with IBD. It will take sometimes a couple days for them to turn the corner. And so you really need to look at about 72 hours in. And 72 hours in, if they're still having a lot of bowel movements or a low albumin, or particularly with colonic dilation on imaging, they have a high rate of failing steroids. And so it's helpful to calculate these kinds of things at 72 hours, because if they and if their CRP is still significantly elevated despite 3 days of IV steroids compared to how it was on admission and hasn't dropped significantly, these are all indications that you will likely have a bad outcome, and the likelihood they will eventually overcome their disease well enough to get off steroids is pretty low in the absence of adding something else. And so things like this strongly suggest that you need to hit them hard up front with things like anti-TNF therapy while they're still in the hospital. So in the 90s, if you fail steroids, the classic drug to which you would turn is cyclosporin. I put this up because this is a classic article. Very few places still use cyclo. We do sometimes. I'll show you the data in a second. I also put it up there to show you that in 1994, you could get a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine with 20 patients. I know very well what a rejection letter looks like from the New England Journal of Medicine, having received many. And I can tell you that 20 patients isn't going to get you into the Journal of, I don't know, the Journal of anything. In 2017, and yet they were able to get this in New England. But it did actually impressively, for the number of patients they had, show that if you take people that are steroid resistant and you randomize them to cyclosporin or placebo, everyone in cyclo did better, almost everyone, and nobody in placebo did better. They then were allowed to cross over and were rescued by cyclo. So this really ushered in an era for about 15 years or so where cyclosporin was the most commonly used drug to use in IBD. But then infliximab came around in the early 2000s, and in this study from Act 1 and 2, I won't spend too much time on the data, and this one as well, both showed that for severe UC, infliximab is excellent at preventing colectomy. Not so much in the fulminant patients, which you see here. In the fulminant patients, it wasn't that much of a difference, but in the severe patients, based on a practice guideline slide I showed you earlier, only 30% of patients with infliximab went to colectomy. I say only, it still is a third of patients, whereas two-thirds of patients on placebo went to colectomy. So it certainly is a very effective drug for acute severe ulcerative colitis in the hospital. So the question is, when you have someone on IV steroids, they're not better after 72 to 96 hours, and then you have to decide, should I give them cyclosporin based on that data from the 90s or infliximab based on this data from the 2000s? Most people prefer infliximab because cyclosporin is a little bit annoying. You usually have to have like a chemo nurse or someone who's comfortable giving it. It's a continuous infusion when it's given best. You have to check levels frequently, but not at the same site where you're giving the infusion. Otherwise, the level will be like 1,000 because you're drawing it from the site where it's getting infused. There's nephrotoxicity. There's a lowering of the seizure threshold. So for a lot of reasons, people don't really love giving it. And when you do rescue someone with cyclo, you then have to transition them to something. And not a lot of gastroenterologists or internists necessarily, unless you're in the transplant world, feel comfortable with the outpatient use of oral cyclosporin. Some do, but many don't. And so then there's infliximab, which is much easier to give and much easier to follow with fewer side effects. So then the question is, which one of the two to give? And so these two trials, you don't need to know the specifics of them, basically show both this trial from 2012 and this trial from 2016, both showed that they're about the same. And so really, it's whatever your institutional preference is. There are a few places in the country that still use cyclo to some degree. We are one of them. University of Chicago uses it, Mount Sinai to a degree. But most places are pretty comfortable using anti-TNFs. And so I would say whatever you're comfortable with doing, they're basically non-inferior, and most places would prefer using infliximab because it's easier to transition them to continuing infliximab as an outpatient rather than moving to cyclosporin. The other really important point to make is that everybody with a flare of IBD needs to have C. diff checked. So we know that C. diff is endemic in general, but don't just wait for that, or don't just check for it if we're on antibiotics or in a nursing home or in a hospital. Everybody with a flare of IBD, even if they're coming from home and had no antibiotics, needs to be checked for IBD. It's endemic in the community in general, and it's particularly a problem in IBD patients, and so it's important that we check for them. So I don't know how your hospital does. There's two main ways to do it. The way we do it in our hospital is they check first a glutamate dehydrogenase and a toxin A and B, and if the GDH is positive and the toxin's negative, then it reflexes to PCR, and if the toxin's positive, we treat, and if the toxin's negative, we don't. There are other places that go directly to PCR. Do you know, does your hospital go directly to PCR? Yeah, so different antibiotic police people at different hospitals decide this based on the cost. A lot of hospitals go straight to PCR. My personal feeling, so there's actually some data that people that are PCR positive, toxin negative, this is actually from the Annals of Internal Medicine, I think last year or 2 years ago, people that are toxin negative, PCR positive, really don't have a significantly negative course. So I'm not convinced, personally, this is anecdotal, that the toxin-negative PCR people really need to be treated. So I prefer this algorithm, where we treat the toxin positives and think about the PCR positives only if the toxin's negative. But whichever one your hospital uses, the key point, irrespective of that data, is to check C. diff in everybody who has a flare of IBD. And why? Because we know that if a patient has C. diff, their outcomes are significantly worse. Here you see a Kaplan-Meier on the right. There's a significantly higher likelihood to go to colectomy if someone is C. diff positive. And so there's a lot of things we can do for C. diff now. We don't really use too much metronidazole. You can if you want. We use PO vancomycin. There is fidaxomicin available. People have recurrent C. diff. We can do things like fecal transplants. Are you guys doing FMTs here? So you'll have opportunity with some of your colleagues here to offer them stool transplants. So there's a lot of things we can do for C. diff that really help its course. And so it's really important to check for C. diff in everybody that has a flare of IBD. This is too long to go into detail, but just to show you that there are these algorithms that exist on how to kind of work up the patient with acute ulcerative colitis. So that's kind of the hospital version. I want to spend just a few minutes talking about how we deal with this in the outpatient setting, for those of you that are involved more in outpatient practices. So we've historically had things like the 5-ASAs in the bottom left and steroids, and then azathioprine, methotrexate, cyclosporin, or immunomodulators. Then we had the first biologics come out about 15 years ago with infliximab as an anti-TNF. A few years later, natalizumab, and 3 years ago, vedolizumab, which are anti-integrins, preventing trafficking of lymphocytes from the endothelium into the lamina propria. In October, we had the approval of ustekinumab, which is the first non-anti-TNF biologic that is systemic by blocking IL-12 and 23. And so we have a lot of different things that we can use right now to treat IBD. And so it's a lot better for us that we have a lot more things in our armamentarium. The question now is how we can arm ourselves to appropriately treat these patients. And so I won't get into the specifics of whether to use ustekinumab versus infliximab versus vedolizumab, which is a very kind of IBD-specific thing. But I just want to say, because many of you are in internal medicine, more broadly, that this idea in asthma, for example, of step-up therapy, where you start with a PRN inhaler and based on their severity of their disease, then you can move to more chronic inhalers, and whether you use corticosteroids or beta agonists, like the step-up theory is very reasonable in asthma. But I hope to convince you in the next 5 minutes that we can't use that same approach in inflammatory bowel disease. And I hope to show you data that's compelling enough to help to make you believe that. So when you look at the natural history of IBD, this was a study looking at people over 20 years of developing, after they were diagnosed with IBD. In the first several years of disease, the great majority of people have an inflammatory phenotype. And if you look 20 years later, granted there's a huge patient dropout here in this study, you see that the majority of patients have penetrating, meaning fistulizing or stricturing disease. Every therapy we have in 2017 is anti-inflammatory. Some of them are sort of anti-fistulas and nothing is anti-stricturing. We are hoping that stem cells and anti-fibrotic therapies come to fruition in the next decade or so. But for now, everything we have is functionally anti-inflammatory. So if you use the idea of, let me start with mesalamines for a few years and prednisone for a few years and then start anti-TNFs here, you're getting a much smaller bang for your buck compared to giving people strong anti-inflammatory therapy up front when most of them have an inflammatory phenotype. And so there's a strong argument to treat people early rather than late. Secondly, should we give people this step-up therapy that we do in, for example, asthma, or a top-down approach? This study now is nearing a decade old, but still a landmark article to help us understand or answer this question. So this randomized people to conventional therapy in 08, which is starting with prednisone and azathioprine, and if they weren't well enough, then adding infliximab, as opposed to upfront infliximab plus azathioprine, and then backing off as they got better. And what you see is the early combined immunosuppression in green had a much higher likelihood of staying in remission than those that got conventional management. Again, suggesting not only that we should treat early, but that we should treat aggressively upfront with strong therapy early and upfront to prevent long-term complications. Because once they get further down the line with fibrosis, then we're beyond the point that our medicines work anymore. And then the final part to that series is, how do we treat aggressively upfront? So this is a study that anyone in GI has seen probably more times than they care to care to look at. But for those of you that aren't in GI, this is the SONIC study from, again, about now 5 or 6 years ago, showing that if you randomize people to azathioprine or infliximab or the combination is clearly superior. This is at 26 weeks, this data. The data has been shown to be carried out to 52 weeks and 3 years. That combination therapy is clearly superior to monotherapy with either a thiopurine or an anti-TNF, again suggesting that we should be aggressive up front. This has been replicated in this is in Crohn's disease. This has been replicated in ulcerative colitis and to a degree replicated with methotrexate instead of azathioprine. So what we've learned is that we should treat early, we should treat aggressively, and we should treat with combined therapy. And so that is great for us because we have much better therapy now than we used to have. And we're also pushing the envelope. So for those of you that practiced in the 90s, the goal was make people feel better. And then the goal in the past decade has been, I want them to make people feel better off of steroids. And then the goal in the past 5 or 6 years has been, I want to make them feel better off steroids and make their colon or their MRI look normal again. And what we don't know, we're not quite at yet, but we may get soon, is I want their biopsies to normalize again. So we're being more and more aggressive, and we're pushing for a tougher and tougher endpoint. And so the natural question for those people that don't regularly use these strong therapies is, are we pushing the limit too much? Are we being too aggressive? And are we going to look back 10 years from now and see that we caused a lot of infectious and malignant complications and regret that we were being so aggressive up front? I would argue that we're not. I think that the compelling data is that these things are safe. And so when you look at anti-TNFs, for example, the largest registry of infliximab has shown that if you really are worried about infection, it's all driven by steroids. And so people seem to be okay being on 20 of prednisone for 5 years, but they're like, I don't want to start infliximab. That's too dangerous because it's new and fancy. And in point of fact, when you look at infection complication data, it's almost all driven by prednisone and not by anti-TNFs or azathioprine. Similarly, large trials of using infliximab and thiopurines show that there's certainly, I'm not poo-pooing it. I mean, there are important complications of things like lymphoma and infections and histoplasmosis. I mean, I have patients to whom I've given histoplasmosis and lymphoma. But if you, and we've all had these issues, my point is only to say that if you look at across a population of people, these complications are so much less common than you would see on the internet. They're exceedingly uncommon. And if you can explain to your patients in a layperson's term what number needed to harm really means and the number needed to treat, number needed to harm, these things are very safe. And what's much more dangerous is prednisone long term. And so something to think about as we put people on aggressive therapy. And so I want to just spend a couple minutes talking about the flip side of this, because we always talk about the Hippocratic Oath and at first do no harm and don't harm a patient, all of which are very reasonable things. But I think what we've unfortunately turned our society into, and maybe this is in part because of the medical legal aspect of how we practice, is at first do no harm is like at first don't do anything. And we have to realize that mathematically, a lot of times the risk of not treating is higher than the risk of treating. And so here you see some data that if you look over the past several decades in Eastern Europe, and this has been replicated in Western Europe as well, that associated with the increasing use of thiopurines and anti-TNFs, there have been fewer and fewer surgeries in IBD. So people that practiced in the 80s, most people that Crohn's disease eventually went to surgery, and now most people are not needing surgery in Crohn's disease. And so there certainly is data that is associative, not causative, that a more aggressive treatment decreases surgeries. Here you see that thiopurines over the past couple of decades has led to a 40% reduction in your need for your initial ileocecal resection as a meta-analysis of over 20,000 patients. Here you see that over the past 6 decades, there's been a significant decrease in the number of surgeries that have happened in IBD, and this correlates very nicely with the advent of stronger and stronger therapies. And so what about the risk of cancer? So we now know, we're all concerned about cancer and ulcerative colitis. We now know that if you can get people's colitis to quiescence, such that they no longer have mucosal inflammation, their cancer risk starts approaching that of the general population. So for board questions, you know, after 8 or 10 years of colitis, you start doing yearly colonoscopies. If you actually can get someone's colon to look normal again with aggressive therapy, their rates of colon cancer start approaching that of the general population. And that's really provocative data that most of our malignant potential is driven by inflammation associated cancer. And if you can drive down the inflammation, you're driving down cancer. So more and more compelling reasons that don't just look at the risks of the treatment, because everyone, I mean, and it's very appropriate, don't get me wrong, like it's very appropriate to talk and to provide informed consent to your patients about the risks, benefits, on terms of treatment. But we always talk about the risks, and I don't think we talk enough about the risks of not treating, which oftentimes outweigh that. And so here you see that if you look at the risk of lymphoma versus the risk of surgeries and hospitalizations, there is a number needed to treat of 5,000 to get one more lymphoma, but a number needed to treat of 7 or 14 to get an extra hospitalization or an extra surgery. Now, I'm not arguing that one hospitalization equals one lymphoma, but when you look at the number needed to harm of 4,500 versus 7, those kinds of conversations need to be had in a way that patients can understand. When you're talking about deciding, I don't want to take that drug, there's too much risk of lymphoma, they have to understand that there's a 700-fold higher rate then that they may get a hospitalization or a surgery, and they have to make that decision based on all of that data, not just the data that, oh, these drugs are really dangerous. And so what we have found, and this is from Penn, and it's been replicated in other IBD centers, is that IBD patients who are sick and have chronic illness are willing to accept higher risks than in exchange for longer duration of disease. This has been shown in cancer for a long time, that the sicker you are, the more risk you're willing to take on to get a benefit. And so sicker patients are willing to take higher risks for this, and so we have to be willing to have that full conversation with them and not just say, talk about all the risks of the therapy without talking about the risks of not treating. And so I have to do two things in every talk. One is the Bristol stool score, and one is making sports analogies. So there's a great, I think the best reference I've ever put on a slide is this thing called Scorecasting. It's a sports book. But when you look at our society in general, we're so risk averse in a way that's not mathematically reasonable. And so for those of you that enjoy sports, if you ever played Little League and the count was 3-0, every coach in the history of Little League tells you don't swing on 3-0. So that you can get a walk. And in fact, if you look at mathematically, the best pitch to ever swing on, it's 3-0, because that's a pitch that's going to definitely be an easy pitch to hit. Similarly, there's other examples there. I mean, 2/3 of the time, teams should be going for it on a fourth down, and no one ever goes for it on fourth down, because in our society, we'd rather incur a risk by inaction than a risk by action, even though that risk of inaction is higher of a risk than action. And so we don't appropriately equally weigh risks of treating and not treating. And so I think we've kind of, to a degree, bastardized this do-no-harm thing into don't do anything, when in fact we should be fairly representing risks of not treating as much as risks of treating. So, and then for my GI colleagues in the room, the analogy that I will give you is from the Annals of Internal Medicine 5 years ago. This was started looking at people who had active hematemesis, came into the emergency room, had an endoscopy where they had an ulcer that needed endoscopic treatment, and they had come in on aspirin for some secondary prophylaxis of cardiovascular disease. After they endoscopically treated with good hemostasis that ulcer, they randomized them to PPI with aspirin the next day, again, a baby aspirin, or PPI with no aspirin for the next couple of weeks. And they looked out at a month and a year, and it turns out that if you, the next day after a bleeding ulcer, restart their aspirin, they bleed more, but they die less. And so when you're having your informed consent conversation with your patient, I've asked this to many patients, and I ask them if they'd rather bleed more or die more. In my experience, they tend to prefer bleeding to death. And so this is an analogy we still see routinely. My colleagues routinely will say stop the aspirin for 2 weeks because it was a bad bleed. If they were on that aspirin for a legitimate cardiovascular reason, you should start it the next day after that bleed because they have lower cardiovascular events. And so we're constantly using the thing that's more, we're so risk averse that sometimes I think we don't see the forest through the trees. And I think that we need to have these kinds of conversations with our patients. And so I'll close this little soapbox of mine by saying that this is from the Journal of General Internal Medicine. that probably the greatest, we always talk about patient safety now. Actually, this week is patient safety week at our hospital. I'm not sure if it's a national thing or just on our hospital. But so every day there's 10 different things on patient safety. This was a study done by some folks at the University of Michigan showing that probably the greatest threat to patient safety is actually getting too little medical care. And so I think we just have to be cognizant of that when we're worried about the complications of drugs and fairly kind of give them the risks of everything. So, and then I talked about medical therapy in IBD. So in surgical therapy, the only real surgery for ulcerative colitis for all intents and purposes is removing the entire colon. It's called a total proctocolectomy, and then you can either get an endoleostomy or a pouch. And there's many different surgeries in Crohn's. The advantage in UC is that surgery is a cure, whereas in Crohn's, there's really no cure, so it's a much more challenging conversation in Crohn's disease. And then just a word on nutrition and IBD. Every patient asks about the right diet for IBD. Unfortunately, there is no IBD diet. Some patients love the specific carbohydrate diet. Some patients love going gluten-free. The low FODMAP diet tends to help people that have more bloating and discomfort. But we know there's a lot of reasons for malnutrition in IBD, and you definitely should do a significant nutritional assessment, whether that's you as an internist, you as a gastroenterologist, you as a nutritionist, whomever that you is. Just make sure that there is an intelligent conversation in the context of the fact that we have very little data to say that one diet is better than another diet, and certainly supplement them with vitamins. So I'll end with just a couple slides on the kind of general internist perspective of inflammatory bowel disease. It's really important these patients that are immunosuppressed get vaccinated. So this idea that they should not get vaccinated because they're immunosuppressed is actually the opposite of what should happen. They have a 7-fold increase of pneumococcal pneumonias and a 9-fold increase in influenza infections. And so we should be actively providing these people with influenza vaccines every year. And with both the PCV13 and PPSV23, the 13 and 23 valent pneumococcal vaccines as well, not when they're 65, but while they're getting immunosuppressed. The only exception to the vaccination issue is no live vaccines if they're on an anti-TNF. So things like the intranasal influenza as opposed to the attenuated shot, and MMR, yellow fever zoster, which can be sometimes challenging if they're traveling to other parts of the world. If they're in their 50s, then I usually, before starting therapy, will give them the zoster vaccines. Don't have to worry about it once they hit 60 or 65. And routine vaccinations, influenza, pneumococcal, HPV, and ideally before they start their therapy, but even if they're on therapy, certainly they should get vaccinated for these things. Blood pressure monitoring, particularly if they're on steroids or cyclosporin, but in general, otherwise it's whatever you normally do in your general practice. Tobacco cessation, the worst thing you can do in Crohn's disease is smoke, and some of our patients that have UC will try to convince themselves that they should keep smoking because it helps their UC. The oncologic and cardiovascular risks overwhelmingly outweigh the benefit in UC. And so even in patients who have UC, your goal should be get them into remission and then immediately have them stop smoking. And don't try to convince yourself or let them convince you that a little bit of tobacco is still okay because it helps UC. It still is overwhelmingly detrimental to them across all causes of morbidity and mortality. Routinely checking a 25-hydroxy vitamin D level has been shown to be helpful, in large part because vitamin D is actually more of a hormone than it is a vitamin, and it actually has immunologic effects as well in terms of uptake of vaccines and activation of the immune system. And so we try to get our patients' vitamin D levels into the 40s. Bone densitometry, particularly if they've been on prolonged steroids, once they're off steroids, you can't usually use the T-score, so your nuclear med folks, or you can actually calculate a Z-score, which can help you determine if they're osteopenic or not and what their FRAC score is and determine if they need anti-resorptive therapy. Routinely checking a vitamin B12. I actually add a methylmalonic acid because oftentimes the B12 is normal, and if the MMA is high, then I still supplement it. This can lead to a lot of other side effects, as you guys all know, from B12 deficiency. Iron, it's really important to replace iron. I personally feel that IV iron is much more effective in these patients than PO, in large part because hepcidin is upregulated, which prevents the appropriate assimilation of iron orally, and oral iron causes the very symptoms that you're trying to treat in these patients because it has a lot of GI symptoms. And so if it's only mild iron deficiency, certainly oral iron is fine, but for most of these patients who have significant IBD on significant immunosuppression, IV iron is probably better. Ocular exams annually, particularly those who are on corticosteroids and anyone who has a concern for episcleritis or uveitis. In terms of cancer screening, prostate and breast is the same as you would do in the general population. We don't know of any data that suggests that these are increased risk in IBD or with IBD therapies. For non-melanoma skin cancer, It's slightly increased with thiopurine use, and melanoma slightly increased with anti-TNF use, but these relative risks are about 1.1, not that high. Nonetheless, all of our patients on immunosuppressive therapy should be using SPF 30 sunscreen or higher and seeing the dermatologist about once a year. There's an increased risk of cervical cancer, so even though now we have recommendations in general medicine of PAPs every 3 years and after 30 every 5 years with HPV, these folks that are getting immunosuppressed should still get it about once a year, both pap smears and HPV, and get the HPV vaccine, which I mentioned before. There is some data in the HIV and AIDS population of doing a pap smear of the anal area because they have increased risk of anal cancer. That hasn't been shown to be, that the widespread use hasn't been adopted, but just remember that these patients are also at increased risk of anal cancer as well. And so keep that in mind. And then in terms of colon cancer, it depends on how active their colitis was, the duration, extent, and control of their disease, and they should be getting routine colonoscopies. That's a little bit more of a complicated subject, so I'll leave it at that. And the final thing that I think we don't do nearly a good enough job of is appropriate understanding of the psychosocial aspects of this disease. So if you remember when you were 14 or 15, imagine not being able to do anything social because you have to go to the bathroom every 20 minutes, or even as an adult, having perianal disease and your sexual relationships. These things are really debilitating, and what shocks me is how any of these patients who have had such awful disease are able to function as well as they do. And we have so there's not nearly enough of an appreciation for the psychosocial aspects of this disease. So depression screening and anxiety screening is really important in these patients. Ideally, if they do have this, cognitive behavioral therapy is probably better than pharmacotherapy. But nonetheless, just be very vigilant about checking for these things before it gets too advanced. And so psychosocial effects of IBD are really significant. So I think I will end with this last slide, just the risk of immunosuppression. Remember that infection is highest with steroids, and more so than the other therapies. We worry about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but it's probably more driven by the azathioprine than it is by the anti-TNF. If you're going to start an anti-TNF therapy, make sure you check hepatitis B, serologies, and quantiferon or some interferon gamma release assay to make sure they don't reactivate hep B or tuberculosis. And methotrexate is off-limits to anyone who wants to actively have a kid. But if a woman of childbearing age wants, we oftentimes start methotrexate, but we have to have a deal where they stop it once they start thinking about having a family. PML is really uncommon, only with natalizumab, and all the bad things that we see otherwise are all from steroids. So the highest risk, as I mentioned many times before, to reemphasize, is with steroids. So I think I'll end there, and thank you very much for your time. Yeah, so not everyone elaborates CRP. It's more in the colonic disease, so some of the small bowel disease won't elaborate CRP. Calprotectin is a little better for that, although not perfect. Also, that can be normal in ileal disease. So a CRP is not perfect by any means. We have people with really bad disease whose CRP is undetectable. My point was only to say that I don't think ESR has an additive benefit to that in ileal disease, but certainly CRP isn't perfect. Yes, so for sure. So about a quarter of people that have small bowel inflammation won't have it only in the TI, in the terminal ileum. So if you intubate the ileum and it's normal, you still have to consider things like enterography or capsule endoscopy if you have a high suspicion for Crohn's. No. So it usually won't be back quick enough to affect that hospitalization. So that's why we usually get it to know when they come back and as a baseline. There is a new point-of-care calprotectin available. I don't think it's gotten FDA approved yet. It might, if it did, it just recently did. We don't have it, but there is in Europe a point-of-care calprotectin. I think that's going to be the answer, is that someone can come to your clinic and get a point-of-care test or in the hospital point-of-care test and know right then what the calprotectin is. The technology is available. We just haven't gotten it. I don't think it's approved yet. So my deal with them is, we'll start having the conversation no earlier than 6 months after you have mucosal healing. Unless there's a compelling reason in a 19-year-old guy and I'm worried about hepatosplenic T-cell lymphoma, for the most part, I'll keep them on. Because what we know, basically I explained to them the results of these two trials. One was where they dropped the azathioprine off and kept them on anti-TNF monotherapy. That was from several years ago. And in those people at 2 years, they had similar rates of hospitalization, but a much lower infliximab trough level and a higher CRP, suggesting that those people did worse when you... So I say to them, you'll be fine for the first couple of years, but then you may need to start the azathioprine again, and it may not be as effective. And then the other study did the reverse. They took combination therapy, dropped the anti-TNF, kept them on thiopurines, and that study was out a couple of years ago. And at a year, about half of them needed anti-TNF again. About 80% of the time, it was effective. But that 20%, it wasn't. And so I say to them, I give them those numbers and say there is this percentage chance that you'll need to go back on therapy, and it may not be as effective. And so if they feel really well without a lot of side effects, my preference is to keep both. If they feel strongly or they have side effects of one or the other, then we'll usually drop the one that's bothering them more. But I try to keep them on both.
If you do go off of one, do you use the same TNF, or you go to a different one?
I won't change it. You mean like going from a chimeric to a humanized? Yeah, if infliximab is what got them there, I'll keep them on infliximab. Sometimes what I'll do is just drop the azathioprine from like the 60G of 250 to just 50 milligrams a day, just for the synergistic, just for the suppression of antibodies
right.
purpose.
So if you're just using immunomodulator, you don't really need the full 1 to 1.5
yeah.
mg per kg.
Right. So we looked at that in our patient population, and a 60G of 120 is probably good enough to get that effect, as opposed to the 235 that we usually use for therapeutic purposes.
And lastly, when someone's in the hospital, you need acute and puts them out, you always use the 10 milligrams per kg.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if it's acute severe colitis, I think you're wasting your time doing 5, particularly if their albumin is less than 3, because they're wasting a lot of the infliximab in the stool. So we'll give them at 10, and depending on how you can get it, I would give it to them like a week later. I wouldn't wait the 2 weeks.